Third world women toil doing piece work to see a specifications for $3 a day. My sisters make my blouse. It leaves the third world for the last time. Coming back into the sea to be sealed in plastic for me, this third world sister. And I go to the Sears department store where I buy my blouse on sale for 20% discount. On my hands clean.
As we were saying with my guest here today, Rebecca Burgess. Hi, Rebecca.
Hello, nice to be here.
Well, thank you for coming in. And well, Rebecca has got an amazing thing going on in her life. It's she's developed a number of things. She's an author, educator, a textile artist, and she's developed something called the Fiber Shed Project. And we'll be talking about that and other aspects of her life. And it's fascinating. And thank you for coming in.
It's lovely. Occidental is a nice place to be, so I have no problem driving up here.
Yeah, especially on a Friday afternoon with the market going, it's pretty special.
It is. Oh, yes, thank you for inviting me.
A pleasure. And, well, let's start from the beginning. And
okay.
You got. When did you first get interested in fabrics and fibers and dyes? What led you to that?
Well,
to this point,
that's a long woven history of impressions that I received probably from the time I was 3 or 4, all the way up to now. As a child, I was exposed to great grandparents and grandparents. And parents all doing what they did to mend clothes, sew clothes. My great-grandmother sewed a lot of my clothes, and my mom did as well. And all of my mom's clothes were sewn by herself or her mother or her grandmother. So there was a tradition of creating your own clothes. However, by the time I came around, the global economy had already kind of set a foothold into the American material culture, and it was a lot cheaper for my family to take me to a vintage clothing store or even buy new clothes compared to just sewing one's own, because time became much more commodified by the time I came around, and things were busier, and the country had shifted already. And I was born in 77, so but what I remember was the impression of, you know, the knitting, the crocheting, the sewing, and the gardening. I remember a lot of cultivation occurring and people growing plants that had all kinds of uses, my great-grandmother especially, and my mother. So I started to weave together in my life this love of the soil and this love of fiber. Mm-hmm. Fiber comes from the soil. And we forget that our clothes are grown. Mm-hmm. And so my interest was always about, as the song by Honey in the Rock discusses, it's about analyzing and assessing and being transparent about one's supply chain. And I'm so curious about and investigating fiber. So for my whole life, it was just kind of like these artistic impressions that I got as a child, formidable experiences with my great-grandmother woven together. By the time I became a college student at UC Davis, I was studying design and ecology. And those two departments never really spoke. So I had to weave those stories together myself. Yeah. And they should have been talking. And there's no reason why, and I think now you'll see it, like California College of the Arts, a lot of sustainable textile design programs. But when I was going to school, it wasn't as available, this idea that, you know, a synthetic dye comes from petroleum. I had to find that out years later. No one really told me. So
it's just there, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just, oh, there's just some amazingly bright colors for you to weave with, but we're not going to tell you where they come from or who made them or how to get more of them. You know, it's a petroleum refinement process that I was never hip to.
Interesting. Yeah.
So my love of the natural world and my love of art and of textiles. Textiles are, to me, you know, you can't live without them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's not an art as much as it is a necessity.
And that's even more reason to make a necessity the most efficient and beautiful and environmentally clean we can possibly do then, really.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because we all need it. So that means 7 billion people on this planet are needing to be clothed, as they are going to need to be fed and they're going to need shelter. Three very, very basic components. So these processes that create these garments have to be assessed for how they impact the ecological systems around the planet. And for some reason, textiles continue to be the elephant in the room. To me, and I think we talk a lot about food systems and the need to localize them and slow them down. And we talk a lot about natural building, green building, this and that, and earthen structures and adobe and, or, you know, in a more conventional sense, LEED standards, platinum LEED. But then you talk about clothes and, well, we have a GOTT standard and it's, you know, it doesn't really talk about synthetic dyes. It's
what
still,
is a GOTT standard?
GOTT standard is the only standard that I know of for the internationally traded textiles that attempts at all to create a certification that you know that the fabric is coming from an organic farm, for instance. Those organic farms, though, there's nothing in the standards that I'm aware of that talks about the quality of the work that's going on in terms of how people are treated and fair trade, basically. You don't see a lot of that. But you see, basically, these are organic farms. They're producing organic cotton. And you can, again, the GOTT standard means that you're seeing the supply chain as transparently as possible.
Yeah.
And they're trying to clean that up. But still, it's dependent on a very, very carbon-intensive process. From the tilling of massive annual crops. These are monocrops.
Right. Like cotton, basically.
Cotton the way that we consume it, it needs to be grown in massive quantities. So while you can do it organically, you still have to look at organic. Organic agriculture is not on its own enough of a definition to secure its safety, I would say, in a climate-sensitive, carbon-sensitive world. Organic farming is... Maybe, yes, no herbicides, no pesticides, but are you massively tilling the soil and releasing CO2 into the atmosphere? I mean, every season annually for these massively intensive annual crops, are you pumping water into the fields where there traditionally isn't water to grow cottons? So there's a lot more to it than just I see a GOTT standard, even though it's better than it's better than nothing.
Well, when you think of the sheer amounts of clothing that are made every year all over the world. I mean, we're talking about just thousands of tons of cotton and other fabrics, not counting the synthetics. It must be astronomical.
Yes, Marcus Bergman is an organic cotton design house, or I would say he's the president and owner of a Swedish organic cotton company. But his farms are all in South America, and he talks a lot about, he calls it the Friday night shirt, and how offensive it is that he will spend 9 months helping the farmers cultivate a very wonderful fiber crop in South America with all the things that need to happen to do that organically. Growing cotton organically is very challenging. He says, we spend 9 months in the field, you know, toiling to get this crop, and then we spend months milling it, months in the design process, months distributing, and then someone will go to a store and some young woman will buy a shirt and wear it one Friday night. And that's what he calls the Friday night shirt. And it's a syndrome. It's that, he says, no one wants to be seen wearing the same thing twice. He said that's the extreme, you know, that's one extreme. But he says it's prevalent. It's a prevalent extreme, and it's got to go. And part of that is due to the disconnect between the biological context that he experiences and the consumer.
Right.
So that's why I started the Fiber Shed Project, which we haven't really touched exactly on the challenge that I live within this year, but it's to bring myself into the biological context of clothing so that normally there's such a chasm or, you know, between the consumer and the source of the thing they're right. consuming in Western cultures. And the greater that chasm, the room, there's more room for exploitation. And I decided to leap over that big gap, and I'm putting myself back into what it takes to make a garment, and I'm doing it, and I'm learning so much, so much. It's changing who I am. It's just driving up here. I realized I know these roads so well. You know, I've been collecting sheep's wool for 10 months from the, you know, the Freestone area, and Martha Kant is here, Starbucks station, and down the road, Johnny Sanchez in Middle Rock, and who's a sheep shearer. I know his ranch now, and farther south, it's Deborah Madsen at Canvas Ranch with her, you know, baby doll and cashmere goats, and then farther south, it's Mimi Luberman in the Chileno Valley with Corey Dale and Romney. So I'm learning placeholders. My placeholders are now places where fiber is being grown and raised. And the community is now, to me, it's not just my little part of West Marin. I live in a region that's interdependent. And the garments are proving and showing to me the interdependence for myself, that I rely upon these people to raise their sheep and shear them and mill that yarn and have that available to me. All of that has created the foundation for what I'm wearing this year. And nothing but, I don't wear conventionally produced garments, and I'm in my, well, I'll be done formally September 12th of 2011.
Oh, the year experiment, right?
The 1 year experiment to live in one's fiber shed. What is it? Could you define it? And it's actually quite possible.
Well, excellent. Yeah, let's go back to that. Now, obviously, you were saying about you know, the Saturday night T-shirt. I mean, that really goes, the linkage between fibers and fashion. Now they're inextricably linked. The whole fashion industry, which is a huge, apart from the fabric, you know, industry, that's a huge thing that relies on the fabric industry, so, and drives it, I suppose. How have you seen those, that connection between the fashion industry and the fiber industry?
Well, I'll try to start with a positive note. fashion is hardwired. Human beings have always been expressing themselves through the colors that they wear on their body. Traditionally, they're symbols of how far you are initiated into certain skills, or how far you've initiated yourself into manhood or womanhood. So fashion, in its core, as its core value, is a form of creating a symbol that you wear to help one be identified within one's own community, for, in a positive sense, for, yes, a skill, or you're married, or you have children, or you're an elder, or you're a shaman. These are traditional roles within a community, and your clothes, your fashion would help communicate that. So, like I said, I think it's hardwired. So I don't fault the people who are kind of, you know, obsessed with it as a form of self-expression, because there's nothing wrong with that. It's the materials they've been given to self-express now in our modern culture that are unfortunate. And the idea that they have to keep up with the trends to stay relevant, to attract the right mate, to show their social status.
Or get the right job.
The right job. All the things, social class associated with the fabrics, was probably always going on, you know, in Roman times. Tyrian purple defined people in higher class, and others couldn't wear purple because it came from a mollusk, and you needed thousands and thousands of mollusks to create like 1.4 grams of dye. So Tyrian purple is very, you know, not a sustainable harvesting process, so only the elite wore purple. So purple, for instance, and other colors have always been a social status, but the consumptive process of just, you know, in and out, in and out, I'm going to just buy this, and then next season I need to buy something else. That is a modern slant. And the idea that a fashion house is providing their clients, their consumers, with four seasonal lines, this idea that we need to produce four lines or two lines even a year,
yeah,
Oh, the amount, just the pressure alone to create a line, the environmental impact of the product designers, the sourcing agents, the milling equipment, the shipping, the harvesting, the planting, whew, and very, very little of it done ecologically. So, like I said, fashion at its core, fine. How we have how corporate America and international corporate fashion industry has tweaked it to keep it profitable for themselves is very, very, it's a tenacious virus that infects the psychology of too many men and women. Mm-hmm. You don't need that many clothes. You don't have to wear your social class on your sleeve.
Right.
You know, who you are is not about what you wear.
That's different now. Yeah. Well, I remember vaguely from my history lessons, it seems I remember learning that it was really the dye industry, the aniline dye industry in Germany, that really created the modern chemical in the whole chemical industry as we know it today. Is that right?
As far as I know, William Perkins, it was William Perkins in 1856 that, through an explosion in his lab, got this thing that he started to clean up, and it dyed the rags like a very faded, ugly lavender brown color, and he called it mauve. And so I don't know if he was in Germany at that point. I think he was an Englishman. Hmm. But yes, the German chemists, and I need to investigate his personal history more. I have a biography or autobiography on him. But yes, during 1856 and up through 1890, most of the aniline dyes were developed. So it started with mauve, and then it exploded because certain upper class citizens, Queen Elizabeth, started wearing these colors, and then everyone had to have them.
Right.
But yes, the first blue, when that was developed, required 400 pounds of refined coal tar to make 1 ounce of blue dye.
Oh my goodness.
So the pendulum never shifted back towards, the madder root, the indigo, the coreopsis, the traditional primary source colors, blue, red, yellows. Those plants were tansy, weld. These plants were just, became part of a bygone era very quickly. Botanic dyes were seen as somewhat antiquated. What could be done by a man in a lab was considered progressive and a sign of civilized society. And, digging up oil from the ground was a big bonus over whale oil or whatever else they were using. This was progress.
Right.
So they weren't thinking climate change. They were thinking efficiency, quick. Mm-hmm. My ego's attached to my experiment. I'm getting rich. I'm going to keep going. All the things that go into progress and unchecked, no precautionary principle back then. And not that there is one
much
yet.
Now.
At least we have the term. We can talk and hope.
Indeed. Exactly. It's interesting how everything's linked, all these different linkages we don't necessarily think of, but they come very powerful package there when the fabrics and the dyes all added together in our environment. Fascinating, yeah.
Right. We think about climate change mitigation strategies as happening through... See, I think of climate change and the things that are going on in Texas and Nebraska, the Dakotas, Missouri.
Right.
From tornadoes to fires to floods, we're seeing a rampant increase in these, I would say, catastrophic weather events. I hope people are not still ignoring this, but I'm sure they are. That the material culture is exactly what's causing the problem, the consumption at the level at which it's happening. All of those goods, whether it's the thing you stick in your mouth or the thing you get in the morning to drive you to work or the thing you put on your body, all of that is primarily a petroleum base.
Yeah.
Your car is made of plastic. It's fueled by petroleum. The colors of your clothes are petroleum. Most of the fibers you're wearing are petroleum. If not, the mill was that to create the fibers was milled with petroleum.
Right.
The agrochemicals on the cotton are petroleum based. I mean, if you take away petroleum, and they were talking about this during the BP disaster, it's not just our cars that aren't fueled. It's everything breaks down. Medical devices, you know, your shoes, the rims of your glasses. This isn't just like the fuel.
Yeah, yeah.
So we have to think about carbon, and petroleum is pretty interlinked. If you take carbon out of the lithosphere in the form of fossil fuel and you refine it, you are moving the carbon pool. You're shifting it from the lithosphere into the atmosphere.
Right.
And we need to be taking it out of the atmosphere and back into the soils.
Right.
And fiber worn locally, I'm a big advocate of this because we've done the CO2 accounting for a lot of these clothes. It's a tenth. It's a 20th. And in some cases, the clothes are carbon neutral.
Wow.
So it's not slight. Shifting from a conventional wardrobe to a bioregional wardrobe, the impact is great.
Yes, it's a quantum thing. It's not just a percentage. It's a major, major difference. Yeah.
Yes.
If you're having trouble cleaning a brand new shirt. Keep shaking that shirt. You can wear them today.
It's not dressed unless he's got a nice shirt on, Governor.
Well, let's go into a little bit more detail about the FibreShed project. Now, this is a challenge that you've put out for yourself, but you really are challenging all of us to really do this. Is that right?
Well, I started with myself because I have gone down the political activist road as a young person and realized that when you scream at people or you ask them or you tell them how everything they're doing is wrong, you're not going to affect any change. You're just going to be frustrated and tired at the end of it. And honestly, the FibreShed project, which is a 1-year challenge to live in fibers and the colors sourced from dye plants that are all coming from within 150 miles of my front door in West Marin, that challenge was not necessarily at all a political move. It was actually a very personal moment at which I had just finished a book, Harvesting Color, which is out now. It just came out May 1st. And that the research for Harvesting Color, it's a book on bioregional color that you can get from all the different biological communities in North America. So the colors of the Ozarks and the Rockies and the Southwest in California. And I went and I studied all the dye recipes from all these regions. So I had just finished writing the book, and I'd fallen in love with the beauty of the American landscape. And I'd had a professional photographer with me during all these sojourns across the country looking for dye plants. And she documented it with such artistry that even reflecting on my trip, looking through her 3,000 photos as we were compiling the book, which was published by Workman in Manhattan, was not a self-published book. I didn't have control over the layout. It turned out gorgeous. I'm fine with it. But just reflecting on the trip and making decisions about the photography, I realized, and doing the research on the resource guide, and in the book at the end, the resource guide includes farms and native plant nurseries across the country. So where you could source native plants for dye and farms where you could get fiber for the canvas for that color. And as I did it, I was overwhelmed with how much fiber we are producing and how much color there is. And I thought, gosh, in every region you could have colors that reflect that community's landscape. And wouldn't it be beautiful to once again travel across America and not feel the homogenization of culture? Wouldn't it be beautiful if we were wearing the colors that represented our landscape and our ecosystems? And each community would be different. The soil, the rain, the sun, the aspect, all of these things are crucial in the composition of a natural dye color. And in every microclimate, they're different. So I thought, well, I want to see it. I want to see what one ecologically expressed wardrobe would look like from my homeland. And I am fifth generation for the region that I live in. And so my family's been there a long time, and I'm extremely connected to the natural world there. The California chaparral ecosystem is near and dear to my heart. So I made dyes out of toyon and coffee berry and coyote brush and sticky monkey flower and Artemisia californica and black walnuts, California black walnut. And the colors that I came up with I'm wearing a toyon sweater right now.
It is beautiful.
And a homegrown indigo Sally Fox cotton shirt. So, you know, I just thought, I need to see it. And there's only one way to do this. I have to do this. And not only do I have to, but I want to. And I'm really inspired. And I'm one of those people who I need to see it to believe it myself. So I did it with a host of people, and that was the unexpected part. So when you ask, you know, if I'm asking other people to get involved in Fibershed, initially I wasn't. Initially it really was very, very personal, and I wouldn't have minded if anyone paid attention or not. But we were in the New York Times today, so people have been paying attention, and surprised by that, and also I'm glad because it is an important message. So good.
Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Well, I think I'm thankful to the project. The project represents now a consortium of over 100 individuals, farmers, artists, artisans, skilled craftspeople, coming together to express what they can do with our local regional materials, giving a voice and a visual language and a visual narrative to the landscape through garments. And so I have now, I think, about 25 garments, including underwear and socks and a bathing suit, which is made of hand-spun merino wool. And it was a hand-knit. So I have these clothes, and I love them. I realize how little I need. I appreciate everything I have so much. It feels like I'm being hugged by an alpaca every time I put on a sweater. It really does. You feel like you're being cared for and nurtured because you know where it came from and you know who did it. And it's so filled with heart and connection that it's inevitable that one changes one's lens on the world when you're wearing these things. And people talk about that with food. They say, oh, you are what you eat. Well, you also are what you wear.
Very good point,
So, I don't think I've... I mean, there's a prophetic side to my personality sometimes. I get a little bit proselytizing about how great it is. So I try to refrain and catch myself a bit from getting like that. But it happens. Because it's just such a great feeling to live like this.
From what you're saying, I have a feeling you're going to extend that to beyond September, I would say, from your year.
I think it's a lifestyle at this point.
No, well, that's it. Almost a year's journey through that. And now all the people you have gathered together in this, are these all over the country or just in
Just
our
in the
area?
Fibershed, just within the 150 miles. However, it's inspired, you know, Harvard now has the first rooftop garden for their art program, and it's all based in native plants for dye color. And I consulted their project for on and off for the last few months, and I went and taught them the dye recipes and the Morton processes, albeit Cornell and another school, small liberal arts school in Pennsylvania this September. So the East Coast, it's funny, I always say, you know, you're importing me to talk to you about bioregionalism. You know, the paradox for that is quite large. And they're like, well, yes. But everyone admits we are in a transition period.
Yeah.
And so we all know this. So they have honestly spoken to the fact, these are smart people at Harvard. They say, you know, we are importing you temporarily and we will be self-sufficient soon and we will have our own experts and we will create our own experts. And right. It's like, ah, yes, that's just the right place to have experts come out of. Thank you. So we're working on certifications as well at a junior college in Marin, College of Marin. We're just in the beginning stages of looking at what it would mean to have a certificate that allows you to specialize in milling, farming of fiber, farming of dye plants, pattern drafting, product design. So I think this has to be a movement. One of the lawyers I'm in contact with, because I am forming legal entities around this at this point. because it has gotten bigger than you. I'm by default now talking to lawyers, but they're nice. And they say, this is like, one of them, Tim Nugent, who's a pro bono attorney in San Francisco, says, this is like the Silicon Valley you're creating. Mm. You know, they're studying the Silicon Valley in China, and they're analyzing how one created the Silicon Valley. What happened there to make that a place, a go-to for technological innovation? And he said, this, what you are describing, because I described him exactly how I started this project and exactly who's involved and exactly what our activities are. And he said, you know, this is the Silicon Valley, but textiles, so you're doing this. And I said, oh God, it's me and a lot of people, but that's what it takes.
Exactly. So what we critical mass there.
Completely. So yeah. Farmers, like I just got, I ran out from my house. We had a board meeting with one, two, three farmers and four, one organizational consultant and a product designer from in the industry. And I think that was it. It was a newly fledged group. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about the supply chain. And we're already talking about streamlining terminology. You know, so we can all speak the same language. So this is the first part of creating a functioning group of people who can all talk to each other. So all the farmers can talk to the mill owners, and the mill owner can talk to the designers. And the mill can become a hub. A designer can go to a mill and say, I want to source some wool. Will you make me yarns for my sweater line? And the mill owner can say, yeah, these are our gauges, and this is what you can get from our mill. And we have a set of weavers and knitters that we can send you to. So the yarn, and we have a series of farmers if you'd like to meet them. The mill could be a hub for meeting farmers and weavers and knitters, and designers could go in and have everything at their, you know, just at arm's reach.
Yeah.
And all regional. So we had a meeting this morning and into the afternoon about terminology. And it was a really wonderful sign that this is going beyond my wardrobe by far.
Yes.
This is inspiring local industry. This is inspiring industry because I want fiber sheds to be reproduced.
Yep.
All over. And we've already had some strong critiques because we're starting a marketplace so we can connect our farmers directly to the marketplace, and that'll be out in late July. So our farmers you'll be able to purchase fiber shed raw materials. And someone emailed me, isn't that contradictory? I said, well, no, because you live in England, so you're saying it's contradictory, but you don't have to buy our materials. But we need a non-brick-and-mortar, low-overhead environment to start this project. So we're starting it online, and we're not going to dissuade people from buying it. Because once their fiber shed's going, they can buy from their fiber shed. But in this transition period, you know, we're not going to turn people away just because they live in L.A. It doesn't seem quite right to do that yet.
Exactly. No, that's exactly. Any transition thing, it's a matter of education, and you have to get over that hump first and establish the basics there, the mechanisms that make it work.
And it's happening by the seat of my pants. I'm just learning as I go.
Your seat of your natural fiber dye.
Yes, my Sally Fox cotton pants. Yes.
Oh, wonderful.
Oh, has dressed you in strange clothes of sand? Who has taken you far from my land? Who has said that my sayings are wrong? And who will say that I stayed much too long? Something has taken you so far from me.
It would go really well with weaving.
It would, wouldn't it? Yeah. fascinating chatting whilst the music was on, and talking about that, really, we can solve much more than environmental problems with going to the, if everyone did the fibre shed routine, that people would actually have, be able to have real skills that they can manifest and work with, rather than mind-numbing factory skills that that we've been left with in manufacturing things.
That question around the difference between a factory system, a massive industrial factory system, and a cottage industry. Mm-hmm. For months I was, I felt like inside I was beating my head up against a wall around the questions of scale and cost, because we live in a world where we're dependent on foreign labor. And so the value of everything, of course, is extremely skewed. Mm-hmm. So when we were looking at these fiber shed garments, or the concept of bringing them to the public, the costs, of course, on first appearance can seem prohibitive. And I had an analyst look at all of the ways in which the hand knit community has evolved, and how much people are willing to pay for a 50-gram ball of yarn, and the prices associated with the hand knit community, who's willing to spend $300 on the yarn before they knit the sweater. And I talked to people who worked in knitwear stores, and they corroborated this fact. They were like, yes.
That's how much it costs. Yeah.
That's how much it costs, and that's what people are willing to pay, and they haven't even knit the sweater yet. I said, okay. And I had this analyst looking at all of this, and he said to me, after many tens of pages of analyzed data, that yes, the costs are going to be financially kind of steep at first, but it will inevitably come down when you find that relationship between cottage industry, renewable energy, and just enough mechanization and efficiency to remain human. And when you find that middle ground, you will find the price point that matches everyone, because everyone will be able to coexist. We'll have this, you know, it is a harmonic point of convergence. It's really where people start to go, yes, this is how much I can work in a day and still stay creative and capable of coming home to my family and treating them well and peacefully and driving along the roads peacefully and being peaceful in my center. And this is, and so that's how much work I can do and maintain all of this.
Right.
So much of this has become so skewed with the global economy. We've lost sight of value and the reality of costs. But this analyst was so clear that we should go for this, no matter what it looks like at first. He said, you absolutely must go for this in the face of these quote unquote high costs. They are the real costs.
Right.
And they will go down. So, and I see that. I can see how that could happen, because now we're analyzing the first North American, the production and the creation of the first North American solar-powered farm-based mill. So the cotton, which is color-grown and requires the same watering.
Color-grown, what does that mean?
The cotton flowers bloom brown and they bloom green. And Sally Fox has been hand-selecting and breeding in a non-genetically modified way. She's not going into the cellular structure and putting the DNA of other species into her cotton to make it green.
Yeah.
She's selecting for it. And she did it for, I think, 25 years. And she's a United Nations award-winning agronomist. Mm. And she is, I think, I call her a human treasure. And she lives in our fiber shed.
Okay.
And she is the one who, she's been a yarn designer since her young days, as well as being a farmer. Mm. So she's a farmer that loves to work with designers.
Mm.
And she loves garments. I mean, you go to her home and the Japanese are the only folk who've retained their relationship to her cotton in this global economy. She went bankrupt. Levi's stopped buying from her, L.L. Bean, Land's End. They all stopped buying from her because they could get it so much cheaper overseas. Oh,
of course.
And so the Japanese stayed committed customers of hers. Mm. And one of her mill operator in Japan sent her one of these scarves that he'd made from her California grown cotton, and it was as light as a feather. It was like looking through a veil of cloud. He had gotten the cotton fiber so fine. And I looked at her and I said, if our fiber shed could ever produce anything of that caliber, you could just bury me after that. Like, that's just as good as it gets. Like, I don't need much else in my life other than that lightweight, gorgeous cotton done in her cotton, which, as I said, her water use, she's watering twice a week, the same as all of the annual crop farmers who are growing organic food. Mm-hmm. Her neighbors are Full Belly and River Dog. She's in the Capay Valley. So her idea is to put a mill where she can really engineer and design these incredible yarns for her community with the help of the urban design force that'll come in, who are already in the fiber shed, who want to be now self-employed, who want to get out of it, you know, the corporate structure. They want to design their own line.
Right.
So she wants to work with them. So she's looking at, we have an equipment list and we know how much the solar panels are going to cost, and it's going to be completely carbon neutral mill.
Mm.
And it'll be on her farm. So she'll pick the cotton and she'll mill it right there.
Oh, beautiful. Wow. It's all in one place. Yeah.
Yes.
Yet again. As the old days, I suppose, really. Was that the case? Did people just mill their own fabrics? Collect, or locally anyway, at least, I would say.
Yes. Yeah. I think they were hydraulically powered mills. So through the movement of water, it would move, the water wheel would move, and it would turn cranks and gears, and a lot of linen was milled this way, and cotton was traditionally milled this way, water power. And yes, there was a mill per community.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
So having a mill in every community is completely sane. And in fact, it's probably likely going to be the way of the future if we can educate ourselves enough to understand the importance of going back to these kinds of bioregional systems. Because anyway, I do see that the power of bioregionalism is that you strengthen your community and you manage your resources with the utmost integrity.
Mm-hmm.
Your human and natural resources. Human is a natural resource, of course. But when climactic change occurs in several bioregions, it means that not all the other communities are wiped out because all of their clothes or all of their hammers or all their food was coming from this one place that just got swallowed up by a tsunami or an earthquake or what have you. So these bioregions, as sufficient as they can become, it doesn't mean they need to be sufficient in all their food, fuel, and fiber. Some communities may not be able to produce everything, but of course trade comes in at that point.
Right. That's still healthy.
That's the essence. We are all for trade. We are all for the fair and equitable trade system. It's been going on for a millennia. We love trade.
Yeah.
We just need it to be fair.
To be fair. Exactly. Now, a mill, obviously the, maybe you can explain to the listeners, the raw product goes in one end of a mill. What happens?
It depends on your fiber, but we could start with what Sally will probably be experiencing with her mill. In her barn, she's going to gin it. So the cotton will come off the field in, I don't know, she'll harvest, it is a varying time frame, but she'll harvest probably in, September, August, September, October, depending on rainfall and all this, and planting regimes that start in the spring. And it'll go into her barn and it'll be ginned, which means the seeds will be removed and the fiber will be, at that point, de-seeded, and then it'll go into her her proper working mill. And this mill will card, meaning comb. So all of the cotton fibers, they're about an inch and a half long, they'll all start being combed the same direction. Mm-hmm. And in doing that, you strengthen the fibers. If the fibers are crossed or going all on each other with short fibers, you try spinning that to create, you know, 4,000 yards. You have yarn that will break. You need them all laying over each other so that they catch when they start spinning. And that increases the strength. So I think we're looking at a ring spun yarn, which is traditionally what denim and most of the very strong cottons, well, all high quality cotton used to be ring spun, which just means that it's a very strong, durable, the kind of clothing you could probably leave to your children. Mm-hmm. And we have open spun cotton in most of the world right now. And open spun just means a weaker fiber. It's not as well managed and it's very inexpensive. So yeah. Clothes are wearing out. Jeans, particularly, people have noticed my jeans are always wearing out. Well, they're not ring spun anymore. They're open spun. So she's going to do a ring spun cotton, which means so everything's carded and combed. And then this thing will be created called sliver or roving. She calls it cotton sliver. And it's a, in her case, she'll sell it to you as sliver. It's a ball of combed fiber. Hmm. And it's just raw fiber. And then that goes into a piece of equipment and it starts getting spun. And depending on how she has her machine set, you could have yarns that come out that are ready for your jeans, mm-hmm. your t-shirts, your very fine weight cloud-like scarf, whatever yeah. you're doing. But in the beginning, because of her wanting to find the right, like I talked about before, the right sense of efficiency combined with the human life, she's going to create a yarn. I think it'll be called a 10-2 yarn or a 7-2 yarn. What that means is a yarn that has been spun 10 times within an inch. And it's, I believe I could be a little off on that one because I'm still learning all of her numbers. But what it breaks down to is that that thickness or gauge, it's a little bit thick and it's going to go into denim. Hmm. So her first project is, we're calling it the Grow Your Jeans Project. And I'm growing the indigo for her.
Oh.
And I've got about, with my Cape Valley contact at River Dog Farm and with my Mount Barnaby Farm in Lagunitas, I think it's about 3/4 acre. Hmm. I'm also growing Coreopsis tinctorium. So we're going to dye the cotton blue. And then wow. It's going to be woven and sewn in San Francisco. And it'll be the first bioregional jeans since ever. Because even Levi Strauss, I believe, imported indigo from the Southeast.
Okay.
So it'll be the first California-grown indigo.
Oh, beautiful. And it grows well, indigo here?
Polygonum tinctorium. Yeah. It's a Japanese variety.
Oh.
Yeah, it does grow well here. Hmm. Got a lot of it. Very happy. Minus a few gopher attacks.
Yeah, it's pretty, of course.
Yes.
Now, the Coreopsis, is that for the yellow color? Or?
It's going to be orange. And in fact, because I teach children a lot, I had this intention to expose children to botanic and regenerative color. Regenerative meaning it grows every year. You don't have to dig it out of the earth's crust and refine it and infuse it with heavy metals.
Right.
And then synthetically dye your t-shirt. You could pick a flower and you could pour hot water over that. And that could be your dye.
Mm.
And a child seeing that color, kind of evacuating into the water that fast, it's a really beautiful process to observe. And children are very excited by the immediacy of the way Coreopsis dye is made.
Yeah.
So I thought it was a great lead-in for teachers and for parents wanting to teach children about the difference between a fossil fuel-based color, basically the ecology of color, mm-hmm. in a practical kit. So I'm hoping to make these kits for children so they can start learning this from a hands-on perspective. So the Coreopsis flowers, I will harvest and I'll dry them, and then I'll put them in a kit with local wool, and mm-hmm. you'll be able to go home and dye your own wool.
Oh, wow, incredible.
So that's one of our projects is Coreopsis, but indigo for sure is, got plenty of that.
The main one, yeah. Well, we're speaking to Rebecca Burgess, and just fascinating, a whole world of what we can do. We don't have to buy that T-shirt from Singapore or China, you know, even though it's so cheap, you know, a dollar or something, you know, most probably it costs to make them. I know when we bought our T-shirts, our cow's T-shirts, I mean, it was only like $8. That's including the printing and everything, $8 each. You know,
it's
so
kind of obscene.
It's obscene how much.
As Annie Leonard puts it in, I think, The Story of Stuff, or one of her animations, she says, "This radio is $4.99. This radio is not $4.99. Who's really paying for this radio? You know, who's really paying for that T-shirt? I don't even want to know."
Exactly. Exactly. But that's the equation. You know, it shows up somewhere.
It does.
We just see a part of the equation.
Nothing is free.
Yeah.
And color is very expensive.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. The earth, those are pigments. Unless you're a bird and you're creating your color through refracted light, which is how birds, you know, appear blue. Mm. It's not through the pigmentation of the feather. It's through the refraction of light you're seeing. Really, the feather is like a prism. Mm. So unless you are a bird, you are pretty much reliant on pigment for color. Yeah. And pigment is heavy. Mm. Pigment is rich with metals. Mm. Pigment takes a lot for the earth to produce. It takes a lot from the soil. So color is an incredibly beautiful but yet sacred resource that deserves not to be abused. So I take color very seriously because I know its impact. Whether you're growing it yourself and you're doing it organically, it's still a very high cost.
Yeah.
A lot of gophers have died.
We have no sympathy for gophers here in Cabin Radio, I must admit.
I'd like to find a good recipe for them. If anyone wants to call in with a gopher recipe, I'm starting to feel like I should lose my vegetarian nature and start eating them because I'm feeling a little guilty. Like, I should make something out of this.
Right. Great hunter will eat, gopher.
People do. I just haven't really heard a lot about the culture of eating gophers.
Yeah, really.
But maybe that'll be the next locavore food. You know, gopher.
Yeah. Gopher. It's local.
It's local, and it is abundant. Maybe little gopher pelts we could wear.
It tastes like chicken, I'm sure.
Like chicken. Use the skin for some kind of part of your wardrobe. I don't know. Mm. It's a resource.
Yeah.
Anything that you're trying to get rid of, I always look at it and go, wait, there's got to be a use. Resource management, first and best use, you know?
Exactly. Exactly. Don't stray too far from that.
Right. Exactly.
I'm just fascinated by it, and it just seems so right. And for now, and you know, it seems like with the you know, publicity you're getting, I think it should grow, you know, leaps and bounds. I think other people are going to get that light bulb, that low energy light bulb will go off.
That's
LED light bulb will go off in the head.
Just the sun. The sun will go off in their head. You know, they'll see the light. I mean, that's the thing I always think about is clothes. I'm working with a group called the Marin Carbon Project. Mm. And one of the themes we're looking at when we talk about educating children is like, how fresh is your carbon? Mm. And you could look at your clothing like that. When did this come out of thin air? Mm. This carbon dioxide turned into carbon. Because your clothes, if they're not polyester or fleece made from plastic bottles, or rayon, which is very synthesized, even it's a cellulose compound, your clothes came out of the CO2 in the atmosphere. Right. That carbon was transferred from a gas into a solid form, and that's your fiber. You're wearing carbon. So if you're wearing fresh carbon, then you're doing pretty well. Mm-hmm. If you're wearing old carbon, you're stale, old, dinosaur color, and fibers have got to go. So we've been thinking about how to frame these ideas for people, and how fresh is your carbon is one. You know, a jeans CSA, like a clothing CSA, is another. So if anyone has any revolutionary ideas about how to bring this into the consciousness of their communities, I'm really open, because we're playing around with this a lot, working with foundational truths. you know, not straying from the core, what we call our carbon core. But
Does the fiber shed allow for utilizing, say, synthetics already made, somehow incorporating them into the equation, rather than, you know, having to grow everything for it, but somehow at least utilizing what has already been done into it?
For my one-year challenge, I didn't utilize synthetics, primarily because I felt like there was already so many wonderful minds working on recycling plastics into garments. And Patagonia, for instance, has a wonderful clothing recycling process. So I do believe absolutely in the recycling of plastic clothing into more clothing. Plastic clothing is very useful when you're out in the rain. I don't advocate wearing it on the skin, because we don't know the effects of endocrine disrupting properties as absorbed by the skin. And we got enough risks. Why increase them? So I'm not into that. I can't support that for myself, at least. But what I would say about the recycling, again, just to speak to that, is there are most of, like, the programs at CCA, they're really good at talking about not wasting, using recycled fabrics. Kate Fletcher out of London does a big thing about the story of your clothes and how old, you know, wearing a garment through the generations, no matter what it's made out of, polyester, what have you. So really, fiber shed is one facet of a multifaceted solution towards more sustainable wardrobes.
Yeah.
And recycling will be and is one of them. It's extremely important. And the reduction in the consumption. If you are recycling, you're not consuming new.
Right.
So I think they all walk hand in hand. And I don't value necessarily one over the other. I know for myself, I just love connecting to my region. And connecting to the land is done through the strategy I've developed for myself, for clothing myself.
Right.
Yeah. So.
No, that's good. Yeah, I mean, because that's the basic thing. You've got to restart that whole process, basically, because, yeah, when you think of it, I suppose over the, you said in, I think, 1965 was when
95% of our clothes were made in America.
Made in America. So, you know, some of that were made, I imagine, more locally. And so I know a lot were in the South, obviously, because of the cotton industry. But in terms of, I suppose it's, I mean, the economy of scale, of going into larger scale things, but, I mean, there will be a space for individual, you know, spinners and millers and dyers. I mean, that's, again, something important to keep the artisan work there.
Right, and that speaks to what we were talking about and during the break, which is basically right livelihood and being able to do what fulfills you in your life. Spinning is very meditative. Weaving is very meditative. Growing dye plants is extremely powerful process of connecting to the soil. These processes, again, they connect you to the biological core of who you are and how you fit into the ecosystem. So that creates what I think of as mental health, physiological health. So I think the artisans, because they are constantly using their hands, that there's an extreme importance for that in terms of creating a society that functions healthfully, psychologically speaking, just as much as it is physical. And also, an artisan is busy. They are constantly moving. I mean, some weavers and spinners are sitting a lot, but dye farming, I feel great. I do like 400 squats a day, weeding and, you know, pruning things. And it's just, it's a very healthful lifestyle. It's one that I would want for myself. It gets me off of the computer. So yes, no matter what scale some communities decide to bring their industry to, we can never growing beyond your means is dangerous on so many levels.
Yeah. But again, the whole purpose of the fiber shed, that you want to keep it local. I mean, that's within that framework, so be as big enough for that area, basically.
Yeah, and so like living in one's watershed or food shed, that has a certain look and feel, and it brings a certain level of awareness. And I would say Fibershed brings that awareness to you in a completely new way, but completely associative way. It's like the awareness of knowing where your water and food comes from, but actually making your clothes and learning those skills of washing wool or spinning cotton, growing the dye plants, learning to dye, constructing garments, pattern drafting, sewing. Those are amazing skills to have. And the sense of empowerment, especially when I teach children how to sew their own shirt. Children are always asking me, did you make this? Did you make that? You made that? How do I do that? So next week, starting on Monday, I'm teaching for a week, and we call it Adorning Nature, which is nature is us and the environment around us. And so we'll be pattern drafting, we'll be spinning, and children ages 7 to 11 will be making their own garments and collecting their own dye plants and learning that process of self-sufficiency.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
That's where it's got to start, I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
For them, it would be normal.
Yeah. What? Of course I know to make my own clothes. I don't need to buy that. I can do it myself.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, resources. How can people, find out about what you've been working on?
We have a WordPress blog, and it's http://, and it's no www, it's just fibershed.wordpress.com. So that's the blog, fibershed.wordpress.com. If you Google Fibershed, you'll find plenty. You're not going to be without resources there if you forget the WordPress blog. And my process of reskilling both children and adults in the art of regenerative color, you can find more information at RebeccaRBurgess.com. And you can read about us too in not just things we've created, but there's plenty of press on the whole project. I highly recommend the blog because it's a narrative of the farmers and artisans. I did move away from just this approach of day 47 of the project. I have not been able to swim because my swimming suit falls off, or whatever it was, that one gets into in these personal challenges. It totally veered away from that and refocused itself on the community at large. So the current blog story is all about Renaissance Ridge alpacas and the story of this couple to raise this herd with total integrity and love and care and compassion, and the way they tend their animals and their land and the way they built their own home and the way they feed themselves and their children. Remarkable story. And so the story became so much more interesting when it became less about my wardrobe. My wardrobe was a lens for learning these people's processes.
Right.
So I highly recommend that. And at the end of this month, we will have open our marketplace. So it'll be the first time we've reintroduced what I would call sacred commerce back into the fiber industry, where you can really connect with a farmer or a designer and a farmer who have teamed up because of this project.
Right.
So the urban design team has moved into the rural, up here into Occidental. We have people working together, just creating, like one woman, Diane Ashby's making this incredible wrapped jewelry. She takes raw wool and lightly spun wool, and I've been dyeing it for her. And it's been coming from Napa and West Marin, and she's been wrapping it into these amazing multicolored, what I would call Moroccan-inspired jewelry pieces.
Wow.
And, she's on the she's in the marketplace. So you can buy whatever it is your heart desires in terms of raw fiber and yarn and dye kits and knit kits.
Yeah.
And 10% of the money, because all the money goes back to these people, the producers of these goods.
Right.
But 10% is going back to the organization so that we can buy milling equipment. And as we buy more milling equipment, the marketplace becomes better and better and better.
Right.
So we're starting where we are. You can buy some raw wool until we get a mill. No. There's a little more than raw wool, but you can buy raw wool.
Yeah. Well, you've made a lot of your own clothes. Anything that you said, your swimsuit fell off or whatever. Is there anything came out of that whole process that was surprising or interesting or unusual?
I think there's There's varied things around me being a guinea pig and a research and design. Basically, I'm a house for R&D. My closet is all R&D. And
we can take it off your taxes at least.
I know. I think what I learned is that I could not only survive, I could thrive in these clothes. I live in a very cold, north-facing slope with water running basically under my house in the San Geronimo Valley. And my house, at one point I woke up and there was frost on my floor.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's a really cool little cottage. And I survived this winter with the warmth of alpaca and Corriedale cross wool, leggings hand knit with indigo stripes, and layer upon layer of animal fibers is what kept me really in some ways alive and happy. So I think that was the most amazing thing, was that I didn't need the Patagonia fleece. I didn't need the plastic rain gear. I didn't need the sports equipment. I didn't need all of this outdoor gear, because I love to run and hike and bike. I actually didn't need anything to help me do that other than what was available to me in my own region. And that was super surprising. You can still take a yoga class if you want to.
Right. Fascinating. Oh, beautiful.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, thank you so much, Rebecca Burgess.
You're welcome.
Oh,
thank you.
Just a wonderful, wonderful concept, and it's really happening. You've made something happen that can have just amazing repercussions for everybody. It's just fabulous.
Well, thank you for appreciating it and for having me on today and seeing the value in it, because that's what makes this happen.
People noticing.
People noticing, people caring, and people being receptive. And that takes an awake mind and an open heart. So I really appreciate it. Thank you. Oh,
you're very welcome. Thank you so much, Rebecca.
Thank you. Okay.
Oh, you ain't gonna make a cotton picker out of me. Boom, boom, boom. No, you ain't gonna make a cotton picker out of me. Boom. Bong, bong, you can make a man laugh, or make a man cry, or shake the stars right out of the sky, but you ain't gonna make a cotton picker out of me.